Hi, thank you. Welcome, Richard. Welcome, everybody. I've been asked to just give an introduction because of my role within the Bureau of Economic Growth, Environment, and Education, Education and Environment in USAID. And we're working with the Global Development Lab on new scaling initiatives. And so coordinating with the Bureau and the different offices throughout the agency. And MPEP, the office, is also in the E3 Bureau. I'd like to thank Richard for coming. We're very delighted to have him here. Richard has over 10 years of experience working as a thought leader on scaling. He's the founder and principal of the Center for Large-Scale Social Change, which advises many partners on policy initiatives, strategic thinking, and thought partnership on how to scale up and have high impact results throughout the world in different initiatives. He's speaking today on agriculture, but has experience in many different sectors. And is an economist by trade and has been working with Feed the Future and many of the missions in USAID and the Bureau for Food Security on helping think through how to scale up and create large impact, not just direct beneficiaries, but looking at how they can leverage money and resources, leverage the private sector to create large social change. Richard's approach to scaling is very much aligned with the MPEP's office work on market systems and also on using markets and scaling through markets. So we encourage everybody here during the question and answer session to please, you know, give your thoughts and experiences, especially related to market systems and facilitation. So with that, I'd like to introduce Richard. Thank you.
So I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for coming out on a rainy June morning. I guess I'll get started, first of all, talking about at least what's different and what's changing in terms of the perspective of scaling up, particularly for the Bureau of Food Security and Feed the Future. Well, I think the market system or the value chain approach that that E3 and Gene Downing and others in particular have been instrumental in developing and refining over the last few decades has always had a very strong element of scaling. Often the other incentives and structures in the agency have militated in terms of a different approach to scaling, which is basically we have this much time, this much resources, how many people can we reach? And which has not really been the intention of the market system or the value chain approach. However, now that Feed the Future is in its third or fourth year, the Bureau of Food Security and the other parts of the agency that have been involved with it, and actually other agencies too, as some of you probably know, Feed the Future also includes USDA and several other parts of the U.S. government, are now very interested in scaling and have started to think about scaling in a different way, much more aligned with the way that actually has been embedded in the market systems approach. The first thing is it's not so much about what can USAID do with the resources and the time it has, but what can we do to reach population scale? In most countries and in most cases and in most sectors, the Feed the Future resources are simply insufficient to do that by itself. And so we have a couple of different options, and I'll get into that in a minute. But one of the options is certainly to work with other partners to leverage resources, either the public sector or other donors. Obviously, the second and this is not in the right order, the primary choice is actually to leverage resources from the private sector and to get the private sector to both drive the chain and make scaling up sustainable. And last but not least, it's not simply about how many direct beneficiaries, as Justin just said, that a USAID BFS Feed the Future project can reach directly, but how can we, choose your word, catalyze, leverage, create a critical mass or a tipping point that allows for scaling up to go viral, to become spontaneous, and to reach population level. So we start to think about this approach to scaling up, and particularly about this emphasis on population level, as a framework that I helped develop at the Brookings Institution, but the primary authors were Johannes Lynn and Arne Hartman, and you can find it on the Brookings website, which emphasizes what they call drivers, spaces, and pathways, And this is also very much aligned with a framework that I helped develop when I was at MSI for several years, thinking about the various, the what, how, who, and where of scaling up. What is the innovation or the technology we're trying to scale? What do we mean by scale? And not just in terms of numbers, but impact and context and sustainability. And who's going to do it? Who's going to drive it? So there's several of the frameworks that have been developed in the last 10 years to look at scaling, that whether it's the Brookings Hartman-Lynn one or the MSI one that Larry Cooley and I co-developed. Both have this emphasis on the importance of having someone proactively drive and manage the process. And one of the things I'll get into is who does that. The second thing that's really important is aligning incentives or the politics. Once you figure out who's going to do it, well, why should they do it? And in this particular case, one of the things we look at is everything from the direct adopter, so it could be a farmer, but in some cases it's an input supplier, some cases it's a buyer or another market actor. But even when the primary adopter is a farmer, there's a whole value chain or ecosystem or set of spaces, if you prefer, of actors who have to be aligned with that in order for this innovation to go to scale and to become sustainable. And for public sector actors, we often talk about it getting the politics right. For the bureaucracy, if it's relevant, it's a different set of incentives. And finally, most importantly, if we're using a market systems approach, it's how do we make sure that what I'd like to call and will be calling today the business case is aligned. So how do we know that farmers are going to make money, that agri-dealers are going to make money at this? And because otherwise, when we walk away, this is neither going to go to scale nor be sustainable. And last but not least, there are other parts of the ecosystem, many of which are, we hope, will be driven by private sector actors, such as financial support, the policy-enabled environment that need to be in place for scaling. So if you put these pieces together, basically we're talking about three things. One is that we're scaling up, in the context of Feed the Future, a series of new technology packages. And I want to emphasize the word packages. One of the things that I learned in my many years at MSI was that we often tend, when I work with an organization or an NGO or a USAID project and I say, what are you scaling? They'll say, high-yielding hybrid maize seeds. And I'll say, well, that's great. And you just drop them from helicopters. I say, no. There's this whole package of how we introduce them. They have to be used with fertilizer. There's new good agricultural practices such as land leveling, if it's rice, things like, I'm sure some of you know this stuff, systems of rice intensification, spacing, soil conservation, integrated pest management, et cetera, et cetera. So it turns out it's not just the technology, but it's often bundled with other things, both intangible things, such as how do you motivate farmers to adopt this, and also tangible things, as I just alluded to, fertilizer, good agricultural practices together. So one of the key issues in the scaling work is to identify what is the bundle that's being proposed or implemented and which parts of that bundle should be or should not be scaled or could be scaled. And often you scale things or you want to be in that bundle things not just because they have technology or technological complements with the core technology, in this case seeds, but actually because they create positive financial incentives and a business case for the actors in the value chain to be able to make a profit. Okay, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but I'll just give you a very quick example. One of the key issues often in scaling is, do you have a viable embedded extension service once the project leaves? Okay, who's going to provide advice to farmers? And in many countries have experimented, the names change. In a lot of East Africa, they're called village-based agricultural agents or VBAs. In Cambodia, they're called village agricultural health or crop workers, et cetera, et cetera. They're basically paraprofessionals or informal workers who often, from the village, who buy inputs from an agri-dealer and then sell them in small packets at small prices. And they are also trained to give advice. Okay. Well, that's great, but are farmers willing to pay for that? Is the margins and the markups they can earn on what they sell enough to cover the cost of training and for them to stay in business? It turns out that the most profitable thing for those people to actually sell and deliver are veterinary services, animal health services, because if I have a $500 cow, that's probably 75, 90, 99% of my assets in addition to land. But many of the Feed the Future projects have focused on other areas, mostly crops. They focus on staple cereals, horticulture, etc. So in this case, it sometimes makes sense to bundle scaling up high-yielding hybrid maize with, for example, cows or sheep or pigs or something else. Not so much necessarily because it makes sense from an agricultural or a nutrition or a poverty way, though it often does, but because it makes other parts of the value chain viable. Does that make sense? Okay. So thinking about what these new technology packages are, both contained within themselves, what do I need to get the high-yielding hybrid maize to work? And secondly, what things do I need to bundle or unbundle with it to make the whole economics of it make sense for the actors involved? These technology packages in the context of Feed the Future are supposed to not only have impact on incomes, but also on poverty, nutrition, and stunting. And so, as Justin mentioned, I'm an economist by training. When you take Macro 101, which I'm sure many of you suffered through, one of the things you first learn is they talk about instruments and goals, which is if the Federal Reserve wants to reduce both inflation and unemployment, but it only can control one instrument, it can't achieve it. And so the interesting question for me, and I'll get back to this, or you can ask about it in Feed the Future, is are there enough instruments in Feed the Future to achieve multiple and very diverse goals? Because the goals are reducing poverty, improving incomes, improving nutrition, reducing stunting, and also there, as I'm sure you're all aware of, cross-cutting goals about gender and climate change as well. So there's a lot of objectives here. How do we hit all those objectives with one technology package, etc.? Just want to be clear, I already alluded to this, that when we're talking about scaling in the context of Feed the Future, we are not talking about this USAID Feed the Future project currently has 10,000 people. We're going to go to 20,000 or 30,000 or 50,000. There's potentially 500,000 farmers in an appropriate agroecological zone who could grow this crop or adopt this technology. How do we get something going that can drive towards population scale? What does that mean? What is the critical mass or the tipping point, and how can the USAID project or working with partners create, again, choose your language, critical mass, tipping point, whatever, that will allow us to be on track to drive towards population scale, not necessarily, and in most cases, not desirably, by ourselves? Okay, so we are talking about not just the numerator here, but the denominator, because we're interested in population scale in the zone of influence. For those of you who are not familiar, all the Feed the Future projects, usually, I don't know of one country actually where the zone of influence is designed as national. It's usually one or two regions in which the projects are working in. So that's the denominator we're talking about. And last but not least, sustainability. What I mean by sustainability is not simply financial, which is usually the way we think about it, which is who's going to do this in the future if more implementation is needed. But also, is it sustainable financially for the private sector actors, for the public sector actors in terms of the enabling environment, or the politics aligned, and organizationally? Do those, even if people have the financial resources, can those organizations actually deliver, okay, whether they're public sector or private sector? So I think you can see that this is not business as usual in terms of we're going to go from 10,000 to 20,000, but it really is an approach that emphasizes sustainability and going to scaling up is going to population level. So if you think about this, what we're really doing or trying to do, in a sense, is do two things simultaneously in the context of scaling Feed the Future projects and particularly the technology packages that are embedded in them. One is we're trying to get a sufficient number of adopters to adopt, and that's what we mean about population scale. Those are normally farmers, but not always. And what we're trying to achieve is, as I said, this target number or critical mass so that scaling will go up spontaneously. In much of the literature, there's emphasis on, if you look at the literature on diffusion of innovation, especially in the private sector, they have what's called the rule of six, which is that if you can get one, roughly for every one adopter, you get six indirect beneficiaries. That works out to roughly 16%. In the experience I've seen, and I'll come back to this in a minute, the Feed the Future projects, unfortunately, have not been collecting data on this because historically that's not what's being measured. What's being measured is direct beneficiaries. But the anecdotal or the data that they're collecting anyway are showing multipliers of 3 to 5, which I think is actually pretty good. Okay, maybe it's not 6, but it's hard to tell because that hasn't been done very systematically yet. Simultaneously to getting farmers to adopt and achieving that critical mass, we're also building the ecosystem. Is there access to input supply? Are the input suppliers making money? where can the input suppliers get the seeds and the fertilizer? The other thing is, are there input producers, especially seeds, which is a whole issue in and of itself. Downstream, where are the farmers going to, who are they going to sell to? Can they make more money? Can we shift the output prices in terms of trade? Is the policy enabling environment supporting, for example, the development of a private seed sector? Because currently, in many countries, the public system is not producing enough certified seed to meet farmers' needs, especially if we go to scale. So most of the projects are scaling by simultaneously building ecosystems, on the one hand, or what we would call in the Brookings framework, the spaces for scaling up, and at the same time trying to drive and persuade enough farmers to adopt this, preferably in both cases by working with private sector actors and facilitating their activities. Okay, and of course the question is, in the middle of the slide here, is who are those organizations for going to scale? Is it a large buyer downstream? Is it a fertilizer producer? Who is it that's going to run the demonstration projects if they're needed to be subsequently after the USAID project finishes? Who is it that's going to continue to provide extension services? Who is it that's going to produce seeds, et cetera, et cetera? Okay? So when you think about scaling up from this framework, instead of the dotted line, or it isn't usually a dotted line because often Feed the Future projects, as many USAID projects do, have pressures for quick wins and early results. Okay, but basically scaling is sort of, you know, every year we do another 5,000 or 10,000 farmers and we get to 50. In this framework, there's a shift to thinking about this more of, in the first few years, we start thinking about what works. We identify partnerships and particularly these leading organizations that we can facilitate, preferably private organizations, that are going to pull or push the chain. When I use the word pull, I mean it's a downstream actor, a large buyer. Let's say it's in horticulture in Kenya. It would be some organization that's exporting to Europe and is buying literally tens of thousands of metric tons of green beans. So they could pull the growth of a green bean sector to smallholder farmers in Kenya. If it's push, it might be a seed provider. For example, somebody who has developed drought-tolerant maize seeds, hybrid maize seeds, who has an interest in selling millions of tons of maize seeds to farmers, so they are going to be interested and have an economic incentive to figure out how to get lots of farmers to adopt their seeds. So whether it's push or pull, and obviously that's a case-by-case basis, we want to partner, as you can see in the second column, with those organizations, figure out why haven't they been doing this before? What can we do as a donor and with other donors to mitigate the risk, to get them to initially invest and co-invest with us, and then do some demonstration projects and figure out how we can get early adopters to adopt and develop a viable business strategy? With any luck, by the fourth frame here, we have achieved some critical mass and enough of an ecosystem that to some extent or a large extent, the donor project, whether it's Feed the Future or others, can step back and basically this goes by itself. And we've done our job. We have facilitated both enough adoption by farmers achieving a critical mass and enough of a ownership and intervention by a private sector actor, be it pull or push, that both the ecosystem has sufficient space to go to scale or can continue to expand to go to scale without our support, without co-investment, without risk mitigation. And enough farmers are now doing this that their neighbors' neighbors, et cetera, will simultaneously scale. So that's the approach that we're now moving to. Now, obviously, when you have projects that are 2 or 3 or 4 years old and they're already doing things a different way, it's a little bit different to change some things in midstream. And so some of the older projects were only able to implement some of this, but the newer projects we're moving towards more and more trying to design this in, though as I'll get to, there are still some challenges in doing that. So that's the framework for what we're trying to do. And let me talk about how things are going. First of all, there has been really tremendous success in most countries in getting a large number of farmers exposed to new technology packages. The adoption rates are really pretty good, at least within the direct beneficiaries. And in most cases, the yields and incomes are going up quite well. What's interesting about this, however, is one of the things we are learning about is that it seems to be a lot of variance underneath that big picture. In some cases, some farmers, as I mentioned, this is a package. They're adopting seeds but not fertilizer, or they're adopting the fertilizer but not the seeds. They're adopting the land leveling or the spacing or the deep placement fertilizer with the seeds but not this. So there seems to be a real mix and match in terms of which parts of the package are being adopted And in what sequence? Like maybe they do two the first year, four the second year, and the whole thing the third year. And in some cases, maybe they drop them. Similarly, even though the overall numbers are showing fairly significant increases in yields, there seems to be fairly high variance. And when you're thinking about scaling, remember one of the key questions we want to ask is, on the one hand, do farmers have an incentive to adopt? And what are the barriers to adopting? And on the other hand, who can we scale up to? Well, if it turns out that this variation that we're getting in what's being adopted and who's adopting is not random, but actually there are patterns, and we currently don't have the data to answer that question, but having been to five countries, my suspicion is there are patterns. There are reasons why certain farmers are adopting. Probably the whole package is often related, I think, to resources, whether it's size of land, access to credit, financial resources, education levels, literacy, often age. Younger farmers tend to be early adopters, et cetera, et cetera. But that leads to the obvious inference, if we're thinking about scale, maybe scale isn't necessarily all rice farmers in Tanzania, but only a certain ones that fit certain demographic characteristics, either are able to adopt or willing to adopt, and we need to know the answers to that. Or conversely, if there are the obstacles that are preventing certain demographics from adopting, what can we do to relieve those constraints? And by sorting that out, well, these are the problems, these are the ones we can hopefully fix, and these are the ones we can't. It actually may cause us to redefine what does population scale, realistic population scale, mean in terms of what's possible. So I'm probably preempting a future slide, but one of the things we're now working on in many countries is taking a deeper dive on our monitoring and evaluation to actually disaggregate the data on adoption to get a sense of not just how many, how much, but which parts and why and by whom. To help refine our targeting for our scaling strategies, as well as to highlight those issues that need to be addressed. Okay. Secondly, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we are getting a large multiplier effect on adoption, but largely that's only in countries that happen to be collecting that data, but they aren't required to collect that data, so it's not very systematic. Since in this new approach, actually, I tend to be a little hyperbolic, so please excuse me. But we don't really care so much about the direct beneficiaries. It's the indirect beneficiaries that are really, that's where the juice is, right? That's the gold. You know, that's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I know that if I spend enough money, I can get 5 or 10 people to do it. It's the other 50 people that know the first 5 or 10 that shows me that this is really working. So again, because we don't have very good data on that, we don't really know, does this guy down the road adopt because it's my neighbor, because it's my relative, because he actually attended a one-day field school, because the public sector agricultural extension agent happened to be in that town and mention it? In other words, you could think about half a dozen mechanisms for why that would have happened. We also don't really know much about whether they're making money, because remember, they're playing telephone. They're not getting direct access to the extension. So maybe they're not doing the new technology as well. So you might expect, are they getting 100% of the same yields, 90, 80, 70, 60, 50? And how does that make this the business case for them, whether it's profitable or not profitable, given that they're not getting access to the pure, you know, extension and demonstration project? So just as I mentioned that we're now starting to do monitoring and research on who's adopting why and what sequence with indirect beneficiaries, we're doing the same, starting the same kind of research in indirect beneficiaries, and particularly the question of how do they learn about it in the first place, and what is that? And things like social network mapping are areas where we're starting to talk about in investing. And it's not just a question of understanding why this is happening, but the same reason, to figure out what can projects do to facilitate that. Are farmer-to-farmer visits a way to go? Or if we're selecting lead farmers or demonstration farmers, well, actually, it turns out that these types of farmers are having more multiplier effects on indirect beneficiaries than those. We think we know the answer to these questions. We've tended to pick the wealthier, larger, more well-respected farmers, but there actually isn't a lot of empirical research to support that. And my experience is it tends to be case by case. So what may be sort of the standard practice in, you know, ag about larger, better off, more knowledgeable, respected farmers may be true actually in Cambodia, but not true in rice in Tanzania. So again, one of the things that's clear, and I should have said this at the beginning, is that scaling up is never one size fits all. And it depends upon the country, it depends on the ecosystem, it depends on the technology, et cetera, et cetera. And so understanding these adoption patterns is something that needs to be studied in the context of a project. And in fact, I've last few days been working with BFS on figuring out how do we put in an annual not really evaluation process, but sort of getting a learning process of how is this going, and do we need to make mid-course corrections, not just in the structure of a normal midterm review or a final evaluation, but an ongoing, almost annual basis. Who's adopting, who's not? Why are they adopting? What are they adopting? Who's the indirect beneficiaries? How is that working? And how do we need to change our tactics to keep on track for the numbers that we're trying to achieve and the population scale we're trying to achieve? Okay. The other thing that's working is input supply in most places is pretty good. The projects are investing heavily and successfully in developing agro-dealers, even in more remote areas, so most farmers can get access to the technology. And last but not least, they're investing in a very good and very solid set of extension agents, which are usually not the public sector, though they usually partner with the public sector, but they're these lead farmers, they're these village-based agricultural agents, or VBAs, that I alluded to earlier, and to some lesser extent, agro-dealers. So this is what's working. The challenges that I've seen are the following. First of all, I think one of the logic of the market system and value chain approach is to get farmers to be engaged in commercial value chains that can then be pulled or pushed by the private sector. In many countries, particularly in staple cereals, these farmers are currently subsistence farmers. And there's a lot of time and effort that needs to be made to get them from subsistence farmers who are actually food insecure. They're not even producing enough for them to eat themselves and their family for 12 months, to food secure, to a commercial surplus, to potentially meeting the and a commercial surplus that they probably sell on a local market, to a commercial surplus that's actually large enough to sell to a large buyer or a commercial buyer meeting quality standards. Now, in some cases, there's a 5 or 10 or 15 or 20-year history of ag projects in the country, in which case that process is already far along, and the Feed the Future projects are having a fair bit of success moving into viable commercial production. But in other cases, they're still very much at the shifting from subsistence to food secure, or if you're lucky, a small surplus. And in those cases, it makes it very difficult to find a driver, a large private sector organization to pull or push, because they're simply not there yet. Okay? And so one of the constraints we come up again is that process, I'd hate to put a number on it because I think it varies by crop and by country, but it's definitely in most cases more than a 5-year process unless the groundwork's been laid. It's often 10 or 15. So one of the tensions which persists in scaling Feed the Future is that we think in 5-year projects, but scaling often takes place in 10 or 15-year increments or time frames. How do we do both simultaneously? How do we get some movement towards scale on the one hand and continue to build towards real scale and sustainability through a market systems approach on the other? As I mentioned earlier, the second challenge is that that most of these things are not just high-yielding seeds, but they're packages with fertilizer, et cetera, and they're characterized by a much more significant investment in both capital and labor. Actually, one of the big surprises for me in my visits to the half a dozen countries I've been to, and I should mention I've worked with Feed the Future projects in Cambodia, Nepal, Bangladesh, Kenya, and Tanzania, and there's about another 4 or 5 on the docket for, and I'm going to Mozambique at the end of the month, is that it's not simply that it's a lot more expensive to do this, but also it takes a lot more skilled labor. And particularly if you have more than a half a hectare or a hectare of land, most farmers can't do this by themselves. And getting access to affordable skilled labor, you know, usually think of third world countries or developing countries as labor surplus. In many cases, that's no longer the case, especially in rural areas. As I mentioned, I worked in Cambodia, Bangladesh, and Nepal. All three of those countries and Cambodia have huge migration to the cities. There's almost in Nepal and Bangladesh, people are either working in the Gulf or India, or they're working in Bangladesh in the cities, and it's actually very hard to find skilled labor in the rural areas. So you could see this as a problem, which it is, but it's also an opportunity because, in a sense, traditionally in places like the U.S. and elsewhere, this is what drove mechanization. So we're at a wonderful sort of, I think, turning point, but I won't get into that, but I just wanted to flag that. The point being, however, that if you need more capital and labor and you have to pay for the labor, you need access to credit, and most of the projects are not doing, so far, a very good job at providing that. There's been a lot of experiment with MFIs or DCAs. Everybody know what a DCA is? It's a, what does it stand for, actually? A Development Credit Authority. One of the major problems is they tend to be a completely separate siloed project. And so I'll often talk to the DCA people or the MFI project people, and they say, yeah, we're doing great stuff. And I said, well, how do you know the people who are getting loans from you are the beneficiaries of the Feed the Future project? And said, oh, we don't have any coordination or collaboration whatsoever. Okay. I'm exaggerating, but not much. Okay. In Cambodia, for example, they have a $1.7 million DCA. Guess what? With one MFI, guess what the losses of the MFI have been there, and they're very proud of. They have a loss rate of 0.1%, okay, which, given the loan volume that they're doing, is $70,000. Okay, $1.7 million DCA to mitigate risk, guarantee risk, of which we've used $70,000. I think you can draw your own conclusions about how much additional risk they've taken on, given the presence of the guarantee. But when you talk to the farmers, what you find out is farmers who have resources have not only adopted the technology, in this case, horticulture under the Kisan project. But they've actually invested in additional land by taking microfinance loans because they have enough money and enough land to guarantee that. But this is a good point where the access to resources determines adoption rates. The poorer farmers who don't have much land and can't put up much as a collateral guarantee aren't getting access. And this is a persistent problem. And I could tell you the same similar versions of the same story in most of the other countries. We haven't yet done a very good job of working with microfinance institutions to design appropriate loan mechanisms that meet the needs of smallholder farmers in the time frame with the interest rates, et cetera. And particularly what they're often concerned about is the problems of collateral or guarantee. For many farmers, even if they have access to land and they have title, betting the farm is not a viable strategy for a subsistence farmer. Okay? So this is problematic. Third, despite the extremely impressive progress that most projects have made on creating access to inputs, I mentioned the VBAs, the agri-dealers, et cetera, it tends to be geographically uneven. And that the farther away you get from a town or a road, the less access there are and the more expensive. So this is really important because as the fifth point in this slide points out, Remember I said in the beginning that we're seeing variance on yields? Okay. Well, if you're far from a road, it's not only variance on yields, but it's also variance on prices. The price to sell rice in town may be, you know, $20 a kilo, a 50-kilo bag. But if you have to pay 10% or 20% of that to get it to the road, that changes your calculation. And if you have to pay the same kind of margin to bring a 50-kg bag of fertilizer out into the rural areas, that changes their calculation. So one of the really exciting, as an economist, things that the Feed the Future projects are doing is they're using cost-benefit analysis to make sure that that these things are financially viable and profitable for the farmers. What hasn't been happening to date is to update those CBAs, cost-benefit analysis, annually to see whether they actually, what the calculations done before the project started, are actually holding up in practice now that we're at the implementation level. And if there's variance by type of farmer, size of farmer, and particularly, in my opinion, by location, because those relative input-output prices are shifting as you move further and further away from markets, not to mention potentially quality of land, yields, access to extension, et cetera. So again, very much work in progress. We're now talking about putting in place a system where this business case is updated, recalculated, and analyzed to see, do we need to make changes in our scaling strategy, given what we're learning about the profit, not only what's profitable, but who's it profitable for and where? And how do we need to influence, for example, transportation infrastructure or access to inputs and outputs, maybe affecting the viability of scaling in certain things, and change our strategy to be more geographically targeted? So if you start to put these pictures together, we're starting to think about, well, yeah, there are all these farmers growing rice, but which farmers can make a profit at the new rice? Okay. Does it depend on access to resources? Does it depend on how close they are to markets? Which farmers influence indirect beneficiaries? So we start to think about layering who makes money, who doesn't. How does that relate to the geographic the economic geography of where access to outputs and inputs are available and how the cost prices change, and who influences indirect beneficiaries, tends to lead, I think, to a very different scaling strategy than simply, I want to go from 50,000 to 100,000. Okay? Is that making sense? Yeah? Okay. And last but not least, even though, as I alluded to, the extension system that's being put in place is very good, there's still an issue of its sustainability. What I mean good is, in other words, a lot of lead farmers, a lot of agro dealers, and a lot of these VBAs are being very well trained and providing really good information. But what happens after the project ends? What happens if there's a new pest, a new crop, a new technology that could be introduced? Do you have to have another Feed the Future project for that to happen? What's the ongoing linkage to extension services or information that could flow down? And again, there are different options. One is the public sector. That's problematic for reasons that many of you are familiar with. And the other is the private sector, whether it's buyers or input producers. The problem you get with input producers is they tend to be biased towards their own products. And again, they tend to favor larger, more commercially oriented farmers closer to roads, because is it really profitable for them to send somebody on a motorcycle, 30, 40, 50 miles into the interior to talk to a small village where people have a half a hectare of land? In fact, at one of the Feed the Future workshops that was organized in January in Bangkok, there was a woman there who has her own business. She develops and sells hybrid seeds, cereal seeds, to farmers in India. She says 46 million farmers could benefit from her seeds. She has her own extension system and extension workers, but they only reach 20 million because it's not profitable for her to go to the small villages in the remote areas where it would be realistic to reach the other 26 million. So this is not just particular to this woman in India, but this is ubiquitous in most of the other countries. So how do we shift that? How do we change the financial dynamics of that to reach deeper and deeper? And I think one of the things that when I'm working with the missions on this is starting to think in terms of a layered strategy. Well, maybe scaling up really makes sense in the first stage, in the first 10 or 20 kilometers from the road. Okay. But then hopefully that'll make it profitable for an agro dealer to go into business 20 kilometers away from a road in a village or a town. And that means we can push the boundary another 20 kilometers in. And depending upon how long each layer takes to sort of fill in, you could think about doing that every 2, 3, 5 years. Okay, and especially if you can bundle that with some road infrastructure investment and a few other things, you could start to think about scaling up in sort of that layered manner. Okay, so that's just one way of putting into practice some of these more disaggregated analyses of who does it make sense to adopt, where do the prices make sense, and what's the business case. So what needs improving? I've already touched on probably most of these, the MFI issues in the DCA, a more strategic geographic approach, and also bundling with other things, such as I talked to about at the beginning, then you can make it better incentive for a VBA to go further into the interior if it's bundled with these medicines for cows. And finally, partnering with irrigation. I know we've sort of, in a lot of cases, moved away from infrastructure, but a lot of these high-yielding seeds often do much better with irrigation. And particularly for things like horticulture, if you're going to produce off-season products for commercial markets in East Africa, they want them year-round or they're not going to get them, and isn't rain reliable rain year-round. So how do you, if you don't bundle with irrigation, whether it's large-scale surface water irrigation or small-scale drip irrigation, it tends to be problematic for farmers to move into certain commercial sectors. So I've touched on all these. I think that just the last couple points I want to make, because I know we want to have time for questions, is that coming back to the original pull and push design, there's a really high variance in countries and in particular crops and sectors or value chains of where there is a viable large-scale private sector organization that can pull or push the chain and where isn't there. And, for example, I just came back. The last country I was in was Kenya. In Kenya, there is a fabulous chain, which I'm sure most of you know about, in horticulture already in place. The current CAVES Feed the Future project is doing a great job of extending that chain, working with private sector partners to parts of Kenya that have traditionally not produced for horticulture experts to Europe. And that's, I'm not saying it's a no-brainer, but they're doing a great job at that. They're following the facilitation approach to market systems, and it's working really well. Okay. The flip side of that in Kenya is the maize sector. Okay, in maize, there aren't so many large buyers. They aren't exporting to Europe. It's mostly a domestic market. It's very difficult to get enforceable contracts with farmers because they eat the stuff, and they don't eat. If you grow a ton of green beans, your family's not going to eat a ton of green beans, especially because it has to be eaten in the next week. Okay, but if you grow a ton of maize, you keep it all year round. And if you have a medical emergency, the 5 bags of maize you were supposed to sell to the person you got the contract to, you sell right away to a local buyer because you need the money to pay hospital bills. So this issue of side selling, particularly in staple cereals or own consumption or other things, becomes a real issue. And getting enforceable financial relationships and contracts with large pull or push buyers, which is less of an issue in horticulture or other cash crops. Good intermediary case in some cases is dairy, which often there are both large buyers, but there's also a potential to move through the chain. Or in other words, from own consumption to selling to local markets to selling to commercial markets. And again, the CAVES project, it's K-A-V-E-S, in Kenya is actually doing a good job of moving from the first stage of mostly own consumption to selling on a commercial basis to local markets to eventually linking to large buyers. But I think we need to give more thought in terms of scaling in places where the actors aren't in place in the private sector to push or pull about what do we do in those situations. Last but not least, this issue of, on the one hand, the tension, as I alluded to in the beginning, between trying to hit a critical mass of farmers and build the ecosystem within a 5-year time frame. And the answer is we need to do both. I think we'd all like to dream of a future where maybe there would be 10 or 15 year contracts and you could actually go to scale. And I'll talk about that in a minute, which is we are actually thinking about trying to get new contracting mechanisms in place that allow for a balance between the short-term political priorities of getting numbers and accountability with creating more long-term mechanisms for learning, scale, and sustainability, such as tiered contracts or pay for success, et cetera. The Global Innovation Lab has already experimented with some things like that where, okay, here's a few $100,000, show us this technology works. Here's $1 million, show us it works in a few places. Here's $1 million, scale it. So one could think about a 10-year contract that had that kind of structure to it where basically there are performance objectives, and when you achieve them, you get another tranche as opposed to having to recompete at each level. But this is very much under discussion, a work in progress. The other thing I want to emphasize is that it's also important to have different indicators. I already mentioned the need to have indicators about indirect beneficiaries and to disaggregate who's adopting, what they're adopting, and why they're adopting. The other thing we're working on with BFS and other parts of 3E and other parts of the agency is how do you measure that you're putting in place a viable, sustainable ecosystem? How do you know that input supply is working so that when you leave, there'll still be a place for farmers to get access to seeds, fertilizer, et cetera, access to extension services? So if we can't measure this stuff and we can't put in some sorts of targets or objectives within contracts, in other words, there's lots of, most of the contracts or the cooperative agreements include a lot of activities on building ecosystems and the value chain and infrastructure. Well, not physical infrastructure, but, you know, value chain infrastructure. But there aren't really clear measurable objectives for that. And that's why when push comes to shove, unfortunately in some cases, as we all know, when I have to drive for the numbers, I tend to sometimes sacrifice building the ecosystem and facilitating a process for doing it myself. And so by trying to change and work on both the indicators we're using and the contracting mechanisms we're using to try to get a better balance between the need for accountability, the need to hit numbers, the need to hit direct beneficiaries, and showing that we're building critical mass, that we're creating a spontaneous process, and we're creating a viable market system. And so I think that's about where we are today. I'm sorry if I talked a little bit more than my 35 minutes. And I hope really eager to hear from you what your experience is and answer any questions.